This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn. I'm Troy Antic. My guest today is Sean Matthews, the former head of School of Modern Languages and Cultures at University of Nottingham, Malaysia campus. He has been working with the Institute of Democracy and Economic Affairs, better known as IDEAS, on a project to address higher education governance. His paper is titled Autonomy and Accountability in Higher Education, Lessons from Ghana and Mexico. Sean is joining me now from Berlin, where he is currently based for research. Sean, thank you so much for joining me.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
Can we start with the origins of this collaboration? How did the idea for this project come about?
The project actually has been funded by the Syme Darby Foundation, and I think for a while there's been a concern amongst higher education practitioners and politicians about the direction of particularly Malaysian higher education and how are we going to improve the system, what's the strategic imperatives for the system. So IDEAS stepped forward, led by Tan Sri Zulkifli, the former USM Vice-Chancellor, and he's led this project, bringing together a number of us to think about the situation both in Malaysia and more broadly in the region and internationally about how we run universities, accountability, autonomy, and some serious questions about future opportunities.
Is this area something that you've been working on? Because it's quite a departure from the school that you used to head.
Yeah, it's interesting. Since I've been in Malaysia, I found myself drawn from a kind of cultural studies background into histories of international education and the kind of strategic objectives within transnational education. Working for the University of Nottingham Malaysia campus, obviously, we're very concerned to be contributing to the higher education environment in Malaysia. And we're also very conscious that we're one of the leaders in transnational education, and therefore we've got to think on our feet as we develop and improve our own offer. So it's kind of because I'm here, I've found it necessary to think more and more about these things. And I was very lucky that I had a very supportive provost, Professor Christine Enyu, who's now the provost at Warwick University in the UK. But she's been a leading thinker about transnational education. And we set up an entity called the Knowledge Without Borders Network to think about higher education in an international context. So over the years, I've been drawn more and more into thinking about these questions.
The two traits, autonomy and accountability, that is part of the focus of university governance. But what does it mean actually for maybe students and teachers like yourself?
Okay, I think these are two really interesting catch-all terms. Accountability is something that we found more and more to be, if you like, a function of what in the last couple of decades we're calling the new public management, which is ways in which all kind of areas of public services that are funded by the state, funded from your taxes or from your fees, are these elements of our work, are they efficient? Are they being managed properly? And so this notion of accountability is that we find ways to measure, to assess, to ensure quality. And so, like in schools, just as much in universities, we need to be able to account for the money that we're spending and the time that we're spending and the resources that we're utilizing. At the same time, in university, in the higher education world, there is a very, very strong tradition, almost a requirement, UNESCO and the United Nations would say it's a principle of academic freedom. Academic freedom is the freedom to think long-term in ways that maybe politicians don't have the same responsibility for the long-term. They have to get re-elected every few years, so they're perhaps more concerned sometimes with what's happening in the next year or two. Universities, engineers, scientists, they're people who are thinking, well, in 20 years, maybe this will be a useful idea. And work that I'm doing now, blue skies research, it may not have an immediate economic impact, but it's the sort of thing that might in the long term have an effect. So autonomy is important for the ways in which, certainly in a lot of research, there isn't an immediate financial or economic or even social benefit. At the same time, academic freedom is perhaps in some ways more commonly known in the sense of people talking what we call speaking truth to power, which is where people who work in politics, who work in social sciences, they need to know that if they say something that maybe the prime minister or the president or the local MP doesn't like, they're not going to be sacked for having had that academic opinion, that scholarly opinion. For instance, I don't know if somebody in social sciences is able to demonstrate through clear scholarly work that a particular government policy is damaging for a particular sect of society. They don't want to be told that they can't be doing that research or that they can't be publishing that research because it's upsetting for the government. So it's also very important at the same time as being accountable to the government that and to the people that we are free from too close or too determining an intervention or from the government or from whatever local powers might be inclined to interfere in the work of a university. So autonomy and accountability are almost like the yin and yang of university experience. Are we free enough to do the work that we need to do, but are we also showing that we're working well and we're making the best use of resources? So these are always delicate questions.
And have you found some of the answers of how the people in Ghana and Mexico are doing?
Yeah, well, what's very interesting is that my aspect of the project was to look at international examples. And to be entirely frank, I thought that I would be looking at the United States and the UK and Europe, which is obviously where much of my training and experience took place. However, as it developed, it became clear that those examples, the examples of what we might even think of as world-leading universities, there many of the top universities in the world are located, obviously, in the States and in Europe. We found that maybe the context and the objectives and the history of those universities was rather different from that of a university in a post-colonial environment or a university in a developing environment, a middle-income nation, that many of the resources and many of the strategic objectives of your Harvard and your Yale and your Oxford and Cambridge are really a world away from what we're looking to achieve in places like Malaysia or even Korea or Taiwan or any of these other countries. So what we found was that it would be much more interesting to look at the ways in which maybe some less considered countries address questions of autonomy and accountability. And so eventually I plumped for Ghana and Mexico, which might initially seem rather odd choices. But Ghana, in fact, is a very interesting parallel to Malaysia. It became independent at much the same time. It's about the same size in terms of population. And it's faced with similar problems in that there are large areas of the country which are not urbanized, which are quite difficult to access, which are in some ways underdeveloped. And they present any government or state authority with a lot of challenges in trying to ensure that they kind of keep up with the urbanized rise of a middle class and a much more educated public. So Ghana has those parallels. It also has parallels in terms of its resource level, in that they have oil and gas resources that at a certain point made them one of the fastest growing economies on the planet. Mexico is really interesting because it's not an Anglophone environment. There are hundreds of languages in Mexico, but certainly English isn't one of their primary languages. And so they're first of all parallel in that there are language questions and national language questions about how one runs a university. Also, because of the nature of political history in Mexico, it's often been a quite authoritarian government, but there's an amazing principle in the constitution in Mexico, which is that the universities should have complete autonomy. So despite the fact that it is 80% of the funding of universities comes from the Mexican government, the Mexican state, there is extraordinary autonomy. And often in times of great political conflict, people rely upon the universities almost as a safe haven, as a sanctuary. That's where they can go and they know that that they will be safe and that the universities have this constitutional autonomy. So that's an important thing for thinking about Mexico. The other important thing for thinking about Mexico is that for the longest time, it's resisted the kinds of university reform that are associated with, if you think maybe first world universities, with the United States and with the UK. They've resisted particularly the kind of management models and rankings models that have become dominant in the West. And so what we were interested in was, well, how do they manage to ensure that their universities function? There was a really interesting report where the European Union was saying, well, how can we collaborate better with Mexico? And the first half of the report is saying, we don't understand Mexico. The system is something that's very alien to us. And so for our project, it's obviously very interesting to see how does a functioning, growing higher education system that's so different from the systems that we're used to. How does that work, and can we take any lessons from that?
I'm speaking today to Sean Matthews about the autonomy and accountability in higher education. I'll get him to explain a little bit more about why he thinks we can't replicate a Harvard or Oxford here after this short break. You're listening to BFM 89.9. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Troy Antek. My guest today is Sean Matthews, who has been working with ideas on a project concerning higher education governance. He wrote a paper on lessons we can learn from Ghana and Mexico in terms of how our higher education sector is set up. So very interesting scenarios that you've looked at, Mexico and Ghana there. But in the case of the Mexican universities, is it realistic to expect a modern university now to withdraw from this global ranking system? How do they expect to attract international students if they are not participate in rankings like these?
Okay, I'm going to have to take a short diversion through talking about the nature of world university rankings and just explaining the position here in a little more depth. In brief, there are two main sources of rankings. There are, in some countries, very highly developed local rankings, which draw upon very consistent and broad data in order to give people information about what's going on in particular local universities. The American example is the best example here. For over 100 years, there have been a body that has been collecting data on universities. And so if you are choosing which university to go to or which university to leave your legacy to, you can access information about the nature of the student body, the nature of the resources, the nature of publications, the nature of religious affiliations and so forth. And I don't think anybody is saying that that level of accountability is problematic. I'm certainly not saying that. However, in the 21st century, really only since 2003 or 2004, there's been a move toward what we call world rankings and world university rankings. And this comes out from one particular body, which is a Chinese body, the Shanghai Jiao Tong, and really another body that's the Times Higher, the Times rankings. There's another body called QS, that's a slightly smaller ranking body. Anyway, so these three groups have been thinking, well, how can we compare all of the world's universities? In fact, they only compare about 1,000 of the world's universities, and so it's not really all the world's universities, but they're thinking, how can we say which universities are better than others? Now, there's only so much data that we have that allows you to make that sort of comparison, and the data is around how many students, maybe around how many publications, maybe around levels of funding, maybe around levels of prizes. The Shanghai Jiao Tong, for instance, puts very great weight to people who have Nobel Prizes and Fields Medals. Okay, so that's a big marker of esteem in a university's achievements. But the other thing that all of these rankings organizations use is different kinds of reputational survey. So, for instance, in the latest calculation, if you fold together numbers of publications and reputational surveys, something like 70% of the Times education is based on what people think about top universities. Now, if I'm deciding whether or not my child is going to go to, I don't know, University of Malaya or to the University of Nottingham, obviously, if I hear that the University of Malaya is 120 and Nottingham is 50, then I might think, oh, Nottingham's a good place to go. However, if you drill more deeply, what you're finding there is that you're not really learning very much about what your child is potentially studying. You're not able to compare in those world rankings what happens in a classroom, what the ratio is of students to teachers, what the nature of the library is, perhaps, what the computer facilities are, what the contact hours are. Those are the sort of details that you need to be much more alert to those local data sets that we were talking about earlier. So I think in the case of the world rankings, there's obviously a skewing towards the existing important or well-known universities, because simply if somebody says to you, even if you're a kind of very experienced academic, what are the best universities in the world? You're going to say, Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, and Yale. That's just a given. So there is a kind of bias built into the world rankings towards the better known universities and the universities that have been established for a long time and have superior resources. There's also a bias, frankly, towards Anglophone universities, to those universities which are able to publish in English and which maybe host some of the major international journals. Maybe those universities, particularly in the United States, which have massive funding from the defense establishment for scientific development. So all of those factors mean that there isn't really going to be that much change in the world university rankings. And in fact, the only way that the rankings agencies manage to effect change and to make news out of the change of rankings is by changing each year the actual algorithms that produce the rankings. So they say, oh, this year maybe 25% for prizes and publications, 20% for research funding. And that can adjust a university's particular position in a ranking quite dramatically. So I think Mexican universities for the longest time have resisted being engaged with that international ranking system simply because they recognize that it's damaging to their reputation and it doesn't reflect the quality of the work that's going on there. Another kind of example would be German universities, which in fact receive very little status out of the university ranking systems, and that's because the way the German system is set up is again averse to the kinds of data crunching that Times Higher or Shanghai Jiao Tong are committed to. So that's how Mexico manages to stay outside of the rankings, more or less, although I see this year that there is now a Latin American rankings that they get drawn into, because sometimes people just scrape the data from publicly available sources. But certainly Mexico has very large, very impressive universities, and people who've had the good fortune to go over and work and to spend time in Mexican universities recognize that it's a very different ecosystem, that the expectation of your university life and your engagement with training, with employability, with social responsibility is different from that which you'd expect, say, in North America. And I think that is the hinge that's really interesting for looking at these two Ghana and Mexican examples, is that what you're starting to talk about is, what are our universities for? What is the real objective of our universities? And where reputation is so driven by research and by international reputation, that means that sometimes the educational imperatives or the strategic development imperatives of your higher education system get left behind. In the United States, they're not going to be concerned with trying to develop a highly educated engineering base, because frankly, that's there now. They've been through development. They are a developed nation. In somewhere like Malaysia, you've got to make serious decisions about, are we going to put our money into specific projects that will allow us to develop, for instance, new forms of agriculture or new forms of work on oil and gas or energy? So there are different state priorities that will be reflected in how your university should develop. And I think that's another reason for being very wary of the world rankings and for chasing world rankings. I'll just finish this little part with a quote from the World Bank. The World Bank says the following thing: world-class standards may be a reasonable goal for some institutions, but they are likely not relevant, cost-effective, or efficient in many others. And I think that's something that even the World Bank is saying. Be careful what you wish for.
And I'm sure many university administrators are aware of this problem. And I want to just read this quote that you wrote in the op-ed. University rankings agency are to higher education just as the rating agencies are to the global financial system. And so what would be the higher education equivalent of the 2008 financial crisis, for instance, if more people are, you know, more universities are subscribing to the world ranking system?
I think this is a really important point to address, and I'm glad that you've brought that up. I think what is likely to occur as a crisis would be in two areas. One is in the area of research. If you're chasing rankings, then you're chasing publications and you're chasing funding. Now, those two things, to gain funding, you've got to demonstrate that that you're going to achieve what your funder is paying for. And to get publications, you're trying to get publications in the top ranked journals so you can increase your impact and so you can make yourself valuable to external assessors and assurance agencies. So all of this has what we call kind of a perverse incentive or an unintended consequences thing, which is that research becomes more conservative, because if you know that you're going to get published for something that proves a relatively, I hesitate to criticize colleagues' research, but a relatively straightforward experiment, you're not going to take a serious risk on a project that might not produce a positive result, might not produce an immediate result, might not produce that short-term publication that can take your career and your institution forward. Similarly, in making grant bids, because very little research or serious research is funded directly by universities themselves now. You're always bidding to external bodies, either in industry or government bodies or semi-government bodies, to support your work. And you need to be able to tell them that you're going to discover a new form of energy that's going to change the world, or you're going to modify the common potato in such a way that I know global warming will end. You need to make these kind of claims that are realizable within a short amount of time and that are going to attract the attention in a very competitive funding market. You can't, in fact, say, I'm going to turn the potato into something that will cure global warming, because nobody will believe you. You can't make that kind of big step anymore, because the funding environment has become that much more conservative. So the first part of the crash that we might face is that we are inevitably restricting the research and publication that universities are producing, because it's becoming more conservative, it's becoming less ambitious, and it's becoming driven by the indicators that the rankings agencies are setting. It's not being driven by the internal agenda or hopes or aspirations of the very bright people who are in universities. Because frankly, bright people, when they're faced with a career choice that says, you can follow that big idea that you have, or you can do this and be sure of promotion and of the esteem of your peers, you're going to go for the thing that is a surefire winner. So that's what we mean by perverse incentives. So intellectually and academically, we face danger. The other thing is that in terms of education, the educational function of institutions, there is a danger that the significant emphasis on research in the World University Rankings is going to take attention away from the importance of developing and teaching the young people who are in our universities. In the UK, interestingly, they've tried to counter this only this year by setting up something that's called the Teaching Excellence Framework, which is a kind of a way of ranking people through teaching. And I think although there are an enormous number of problems with that framework, it is a good first step towards moving the balance of thinking about universities back a little bit towards thinking about teaching. So short answer to your question, we're damaging universities because of the distorting effect on research, and we're damaging universities by the very fact that research is so much more of a priority in rankings than teaching.
Is there an antidote? What are the solutions to...
Well, it's interesting. When I talk about this in this way about rankings and the way in which universities are assessed and thought about, people say, well, how are we meant to judge universities? And if you think that it's only 10 or 12 years since these ranking systems started, one can say, well, what did we do in the 1990s and the 1980s? How did you think about the quality of a university in those days? Well, there are still a lot of single subject or disciplinary subject bodies that are able to talk about what good departments and good work looks like. There are ways in which people used to visit universities and talk to people about what the staff-student ratios were and what the interesting work going on was. When I wanted to choose my university, I spent a lot of time reading prospectuses and going to libraries, because sadly this was the pre-internet time. Now on the internet you can look, who are the people in the department that you're thinking of studying? Have they been publishing interesting work? And so we might get back to something that is more qualitative. The worst thing about rankings and the worst thing about some of the accountability work that goes on is that it's driven by data, not by evaluation. We can always count things, but thinking about what's really valuable and what has quality is a much more difficult and in some ways more subjective activity. But when we're talking about universities, we're talking really about collaboration between subject specialists all over the world. And in fact, it ceases to be subjective. You have journals that have editorial boards that look at a range of different work, and you're able to see, oh, that department's producing a lot of interesting work. You're able to see, oh, that individual has moved a couple of times because they've been able to see that their work will be better in one university than another. So even as an undergraduate, you should be able to think, okay, employability, have people been getting jobs coming out of this university? Even more so out of this department, and also in terms of the quality of the teaching you're going to get. What do the alumni say? What do people who have been to that university say? These aren't so much things that you count. They're things that you get a feel for and you try to find out.
So I think it's fair to say that this topic of education provokes intense public debate in all the countries you looked at. And I was wondering whether the example from Ghana and Mexico, do they provide a good indication on why some countries are more able than others to transcend political partisanship into constructive policies?
Yeah, I think that was really where we went in some of the conclusions of certainly my paper. I think we found that in Ghana, although there are some standardized quality assurance mechanisms by which institutions are able to say, yes, we are accountable, there were a couple of examples in Ghana where they had some very open reviews of particularly the University of Ghana itself, which had got into a bit of a decline and a bit of a pickle. Just like many universities, it had been forced to grow very, very quickly. Staff-student ratios had become awful. Funding had declined very significantly. And morale was very, very low. And so a really exceptional vice-chancellor there invited a body of his peers to come and say, okay, how can we redeem the situation? What are the things that we can do quickly? What are the things that we can do medium and long-term to make the University of Ghana a success? And so it was a really extraordinary open-ended process of review. I've been involved in so many reviews where the quality assurance questions are really kind of predetermined. And you can find that there's a significant problem of morale or of personnel or of resources, but you can't actually frame a way of addressing that within the kind of cookie cutter model of quality assurance or accountability that we have in place. In the University of Ghana, they really said, come and talk to us, go through our books, talk to everybody, tell us how to make things better. And this is this issue of quality and evaluation, where you've got people who are able to say, okay, I've had 30 years in the higher education environment, and yes, I can see that there are things we can do better, and I'm going to talk to a lot of people and find ways to plan and to strategize. So that was one key example. Another key example in Ghana, again, was the University for Development Studies, which was set up in the northern part of the country. And again, it was set up with its very constitution and its statutes establishing its commitment to its local and regional mission. And so it had to take a certain number of students from its region. It had to have a certain number of courses that were specifically determined by employment opportunity and development needs in that region. And it also had a fascinating element of its statutes, which were around work experience and apprenticeship and internship within the region, so that you would maybe be working in the biosciences, you would be spending 6 months working alongside people in farms or people in some element of the food industry within the specific region. So again, we had the idea of a university that was very much specifically designed for its context, not designed to be Harvard or Yale, but designed to be a leading university for its region. And so it's that, I think, was a tremendous piece of work in Ghana. And it's a very highly regarded university precisely because of the way that it has stuck to its guns and continued to try to follow that regional mission. From Mexico, I think what's interesting is, in a sense, it's a very big picture response, which is that, I mean, there are over 3,000 universities in Mexico, and there are a number of bodies which draw together groups of universities and groups, indeed, of stakeholders within the universities. And what's been possible in Mexico appears to be a very hard won and a very continually kind of struggling mode of negotiation and balance about university policy. So it's not the university saying, we're all just going to do this. It's not the government saying, you are going to do this. And it's certainly not the academics saying, we are going to do this. It's a much more evolved democratic system of bringing together stakeholders, including employers and local industry, and saying, okay, we need to work towards a consensus in the direction of the university and its objectives. So what you have there is almost what we would call in social sciences a public sphere, that you've got this environment where people are respected and where there is a negotiation about the objectives and the direction of particular higher education institutions, which again is very different from the sort of command economy that is the case in some authoritarian environments, and also from a situation where universities have almost complete autonomy and therefore can sometimes fail to address regional and development needs. So what we liked about Mexico was this sense of an ongoing debate and a consistent sense that we needed to be reviewing the objectives, but listening to all parties and coming to a consensus decision.
Something we can aspire for. Thank you, Sean, for taking the time.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to VFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.